I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. This Sunday, the 3rd of February, the Emerson String Quartet will be performing at the Vancouver Playhouse at 3 p.m. They're one of the world's best-known and lauded chamber groups. It's known for, among other things, its technical brilliance, dynamic sound, and unique interpretations. Joining me now is Eugene Drucker, one of the quartet's violinists and one of its founding members. He joins me now to talk about the concert this Sunday performing in Vancouver, chamber music, the quartet, and more. This performance this Sunday will mark the cellist David Finkel's last appearance as a member of the Emerson String Quartet here in Vancouver, at least. This is the first personnel change since the late 1970s. Over the last 34 years, they've performed on average once a year here in Vancouver, formed in 1976, named after the poet and philosopher Ralph Waldo Emerson. The quartet has received 9 Grammys as well as countless other awards and accolades. Eugene Drucker is also an active soloist. He graduated from Columbia and Juilliard. He's also written a novel, The Savior, published in 2007. The website for more is at emersonquartet.com. For tickets and more information, visit friendsofchambermusic.ca. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program in New York City, Eugene Drucker. Mr. Drucker, good morning.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Thanks for joining us. So for people that are listening that might not know, the difference between, say, chamber music and classical music, I mean, is there a difference there?
Well, chamber music is a category within the larger field of classical music, I would say. So classical music comprises so many things, symphonic music, opera, choral music, and chamber music, and of course within chamber music there are many different subdivisions. Probably the most striking form of chamber music in terms of the breadth of the repertoire is the string quartet, but there are also piano trios, meaning for piano, violin, and cello, a smaller number of piano quartets with string trio, violin, viola, and cello playing with piano. There are some piano quintets, sextets, string sextets. In fact, our latest recording for Sony Classics, I say latest, but it hasn't come out yet. We've finished the sessions and the editing, are 2 string sextets by Schoenberg and Tchaikovsky. And then there's the wonderful Mendelssohn Octet, basically for 2 string quartets. And I think that chamber music can even extend to a larger number of instruments than 8, and that it can sort of morph into the category of chamber orchestra.
Mm-hmm. And so this show that you're doing here in Vancouver on Sunday, would that be a good way to introduce oneself to chamber music, do you think?
Yes, I think so. I would have to admit that the second piece on the program, Alban Berg's Lyric Suite, is fairly challenging. It's part of the second Viennese school. It's not in any particular key, you know, it's part of atonal music. There were various forms of atonal music that became prevalent in the first two-thirds, let's say, of the 20th century. But Berg's title for this quartet, Lyric Suite, is not an exaggeration. It really is a very lyrical piece in parts, and in spite of the fact that it doesn't have an identifiable home key, tonality, in other words, having a home key, is not necessary for lyricism. But there's more in the piece than just lyricism. There's a tremendous oscillation, I would say, between extremes. It's in 6 movements. The first one is entitled Allegretto Gioviale, so it's fairly jovial in mood, and then Andante Amoroso, so rather amorous movement in which a duet figure first between the 2 violins and then other pairs of instruments is prevalent. The third movement is muted and extremely mysterious. It's called Allegro Misterioso. It corresponds to the general category of minuet or scherzo from the 18th century on, in which there's a basically a 3-part structure, A, B, A. Now, keep in mind, I'm describing a movement that lasts only about 4 minutes at the most, this third movement of the Lyric Suite. But it has a so-called trio section, a middle section that's marked trio extatico, then a fourth movement, which is adagio. I can't remember the exact tempo marking right now, but there are always these descriptive adjectives that accompany the indication of the actual speed of the piece. The fifth movement is presto delirando, a delirious, headlong kind of presto that really explores the extremes of sonority that a string quartet can produce. And the last movement is called largo desolato, so it's desolate music. So I would say that the extremes in mood and in tempo between each successive pair of movements are magnified as the piece goes on, so that you have the largest extreme between the fifth and sixth movements. Classical composers are often very concerned with structure, with how a piece is put together, and they have to be because they're dealing with pieces that last about, well, in this program, they're each about 25 minutes long. And you have to find a kind of cohesive thread that will sustain the listener, even if the listener doesn't understand every technical aspect of what's going on. There is, in a great piece of music, a sense of cohesion that can operate on an unconscious level as well as conscious. It doesn't have to be studied or analyzed necessarily in order for the listener to feel that that narrative arc of the piece. And one other detail about the lyric suite is that Alban Berg, who was about 40 when he wrote the piece in the mid-1920s, was having a passionate extramarital affair, and the piece in some ways is about that affair. And he died in 1935. His widow, who died in 1975, kept certain things secret for all of those years after Berg's death. There was a hidden voice part, for example, in the last movement, the setting of I think it's a Baudelaire poem in German translation, which only began to be performed after Helene Berg died in the mid-1970s.
Hmm.
There are other cues and clues as well, coded messages between the lovers, numerological fascinations and obsessions. Many details are loaded into this piece, and again, you don't have to understand even half of them, and you don't have to know an analysis of the piece in order to be swept up by its fervor. The other two pieces on the program are quite different. The Mozart Quartet is very beautiful and engaging, extremely lyrical, again, lyrical slow movement, but in an entirely different way from the Berg. There is no ecstasy, I would say, in this particular piece by Mozart, but there's a feeling of emotional openness in it, and, you know, just this aesthetic, scaling the heights of aesthetic beauty, I would say, especially in the slow movement, but just a very upbeat kind of piece in general. There are a few dark moments in the piece, but there's a lot of counterpoint in the last movement where each instrument in turn takes up a particular idea and runs with it. A lot of overlapping of the threads in this contrapuntal texture. The last piece on the program, the Dvorak Quartet in D minor, is a relatively early work by Dvorak, but I would say he was probably in his mid-30s when he wrote it, mm-hmm. which for Mozart meant the end of his life, of course. But most of the string quartets and other chamber music of Dvorak that we're familiar with date from a little later than this quartet. We learned it for the first time this year, and we've been delighted with its beauty, its folk feeling, you know, a feeling of connection to the folk music of Bohemia, of Eastern Europe, where Dvorak came from, an extremely lyrical and detailed slow movement, and an exciting conclusion, also exciting last movement that builds up to quite a climax.
Now, you guys like performing in Vancouver, don't you?
Yes, we do. We come there every year.
Yeah. Well, what's the story about you guys trying to get here, but then you got delayed at the border or something like that?
Yeah, our very first appearance in Vancouver in the fall of 1979 plus David Finkel, who had recently joined the quartet, was suffering from very, very bad head cold, and flying was obviously not the best thing for him. But and this was way before there were cell phones. I know that we tried very hard to rearrange things, and the best we could do, also being in touch with Eric Wilson, who runs the series for you in Vancouver, was to fly to Seattle eventually after many hours of delay. The airport had started to open up a little bit in Salt Lake City, and we managed to get on a flight to Seattle, and then Eric was sending a small charter prop plane to pick us up and bring us to Vancouver. So what happened, though, was that when we arrived in Seattle, it was already pretty late in the afternoon, the plane wasn't there because it had been held up in U.S. Customs. Eventually, the pilot found us. I don't remember all the details of how we actually connected with the pilot, but he did fly us to Eric, to Vancouver, and a message was sent to Eric, whom we didn't know yet personally, saying that we expected to land at 8:30. I believe the concert was scheduled to start at 8 p.m. that evening. We were scheduled to land at 8:30, and could he please hold the audience? But somehow the message didn't go through clearly, and he thought we were saying we were leaving Seattle at 8:30 rather than arriving Vancouver at 8:30. So we were there, we either took taxis or there was a car service waiting for us. We got to the hall before 9 o'clock, you know, less than 1 hour late, but a large proportion of the audience had left already once they thought that we were only leaving Seattle at 8:30. Still, we played the concert, and I think maybe half of the house was full, and that was the beginning of our relationship, and of course, every time since then, it's been easier to get there.
Indeed. And you guys were dressed in jeans, I understand, right?
Oh, yeah, probably. I don't know whether our luggage was lost or there was simply no time to change. We've had this situation a few times in various places. Not with those exact details, but where we would change or shave or whatever in an airplane lavatory, just trying to get ready because we knew there would be no time when we arrived. I would say that this kind of thing has happened about four times in our career.
Yeah.
And once we actually missed the concert because of flight problems.
Yeah. Well, what's the audience here like compared to audiences that you've played before around the world? Is there something different about the audiences here in Vancouver?
I can't say that it's absolutely different from other audiences, but we do have the feeling that it's a very knowledgeable audience that hears a lot of chamber music each season. I don't know how many concerts are on the series. They're familiar with us, of course, and they're very kind to us. They give us a warm welcome just about every time we come, and we enjoy meeting individuals from the audience after the concert when they come backstage, and usually Eric Wilson takes us to one of the excellent local restaurants for dinner afterwards, and he invites a few supporters or members of his board, and so we feel a personal connection. It's hard to say what makes an audience different. When we first toured in Europe, this is back in 1983, first concert we ever played in Germany, we were struck by how silent the audience was during the performance. We were used to people coughing a lot. And it was just more part of the tradition of listening to chamber music, I guess, and the sense of discipline in listening that made the audiences so attentive while we were playing, or at least not making obvious manifestations of fidgeting. I would say that in the years that we've been continuing to go to Europe, that characteristic, it either just doesn't strike us as much anymore, or perhaps it's not as prevalent as it used to be. Maybe things have loosened up there a little bit. And also, what I said about Germany would not necessarily apply to every country in Europe where we play. The first concert we ever played in Europe, which was right before that concert in Recklinghausen, Germany, was in Amsterdam. And got a standing ovation at the end of the first half of the concert, and we thought, oh, this is great. Mm-hmm. And then we began to realize that this was a kind of routine thing that the audience in Amsterdam would do. They would stand up at the end of the first half and stand up at the end of the second half, but it didn't necessarily mean that it was a sign of incredible enthusiasm compared to some of the other places where we had played. We've just come to realize that audiences have different ways of expressing themselves, and I also believe that the acoustics of a hall have something to do with it. It's not only that a very dry-sounding hall might be a little more difficult in which to have an impact on the audience, but I think that when you play in a resonant hall, sometimes halls can be too resonant, by the way, where you lose some clarity, mm-hmm. but when the audience begins to applaud in a resonant hall, it has a kind of snowball effect. It creates extra momentum because each person applauding hears this very reverberant applause coming from the audience in general and tends to make the applause last longer, or so it seems to us. So I think it sometimes has to do with the particularities of the hall, and sure, there's some cultural differences in various places where we play. When we've played in Japan, we've had the feeling that audiences are very attentive and polite, but perhaps don't express their enthusiasm quite as overtly or passionately as in Korea or China. Uh-huh. But I hate to indulge in national stereotypes. Now, between Canada and the United States, there are some major differences, but I would say, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think between the English-speaking part of Canada and the United States, the differences are perhaps not as huge even as between different parts of the United States, mm-hmm. Or different parts of Canada, if you will. I mean, it's different. I appreciate the fact that it's a different country when each time I go to Canada, and I have a very high opinion of Canadians. And in fact, I've just been watching the series Slings and Arrows. I don't know if you're familiar with that. Yeah, I think that's a lot better than a lot of what's on American TV.
Right. Is performing still fun for you?
Yes, not all the time. I mean, if one is very tired in the course of a tour or fighting off some kind of illness, it takes a toll. But the enthusiasm of the audience, the people's honest reactions afterwards, those things keep us going, I would say. And as you mentioned earlier, David Finkel will soon be leaving the Emerson Quartet after playing with us for 34 seasons. And we have a younger cellist coming in, Paul Watkins, an excellent British soloist and conductor. The rest of us who are remaining in the quartet view this as an opportunity to reaffirm our commitment to what we've been doing for all these decades, and through the more intensive working process that we're going to have over the next year or two in relearning our repertoire, large chunks of it, with Paul Watkins, I think there's an opportunity for revitalization.
And so how does it work when you select someone to join the quartet to replace Mr. Finkel? Do you know them well? I mean, did you have to have a rapport with them personally so that it comes through professionally?
Yes, I think that would help. In this case, my two colleagues, Lawrence Dutton and Philip Setzer, had each played with Paul Watkins in various contexts. Lawrence Dutton with the veteran pianist Menachem Pressler, who had been the pianist of the Beaux-Arts Trio for, about 50 years. There was a series of concerts called Menachem Pressler and Friends. I think that Larry played about four concerts at least with Paul Watkins in that situation, in different cities. And he came back from that experience saying, this guy is fantastic. And if David ever leaves the quartet, this was a few years ago, before we knew that David was thinking along those lines, Larry said, if David ever has to leave the quartet, this is the guy I'd like to play with. And then Phil Setzer had played two quintets by Brahms with Paul Watkins at Music at Menlo, which is David Finkel's festival in California. had barely met him personally. I think he had come backstage after one of our concerts in London, where he lived, still lives. But he's going to move to the New York area in the spring. I had heard Paul Watkins play the Brahms Double Concerto with an orchestra in Carnegie Hall with the violinist Daniel Hope a few years ago, and I was very impressed. So I was certainly willing to take my colleague's word for it, but you also have to play together a little bit to make sure that the chemistry is right. And we didn't have a lot of time in which to play together after we called Paul from Madrid, as I recall. We were on tour about a year ago. And he was in, I think he was in New York at the time. But by the time we got back home from that tour, he had returned to England. And his wife, who was eager for him to seize this opportunity, said that we should get together as soon as possible to play together. So barely a week after Paul had flown home from New York to London, he flew back to New York for just a couple of days and had a session with us for a couple of hours. We read samples of various string quartets, and it felt really good. Yeah. He is such a lovely person, very mellow. I mean, you can't know for sure before you've spent a long time with a person, but considering all his various activities, how busy he is, I have rarely met somebody who seems so peaceful at the same time. He does not seem driven. And he's just a wonderful cellist, musician, perhaps also having a conductor in the quartet who would tend to look at scores of quartets a little differently from the way each of us does. You know, I think that would be helpful as well.
Yeah, so I was wondering, do you listen, say, at your when you're in your leisure time, in your downtime, do you listen to other kinds of music? Say, do you have an iPod?
You know, I'm not very advanced technologically. My wife and son both have tried to nudge me along in that direction. But I certainly listen to some music in my spare time, especially if I'm in my car alone for long drives with CDs. I like to listen to symphonic music a lot. I don't listen to all that much chamber music unless I have to evaluate something for potential future use. But you know, if I want to listen to something that's sufficiently different from what we do, that it does seem like an escape. I also love opera. As far as other genres of music are concerned, I do get a fair amount of that because my son, who's just in his first year at Yale, but he's a budding pop singer songwriter, and that's something that he and my wife share a great deal. Because though she's a classical cellist, she comes from a background that embraced all kinds of music, which was not really the case for me. So I've come to learn a lot about pop music. I also have a great deal of respect for jazz musicians. But to be honest, it's not the first music that I will gravitate toward when I'm by myself.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And I understand that you've got two violins.
Yes.
A Stradivarius that's over 300 years old, and then one that's newer, say 10 years old or so.
That's right.
Do you use both in the performance, or how does that work?
Well, no, I don't usually use both in a single performance, just because it's impractical to bring both along on tour. Right now, my Strad is having sort of major surgery in a shop in New York, something that was not absolutely necessary, but I decided to do it. There were certain things that I had been told over the years that led me to believe there might be more potential in the instrument, and I figured at this point in my career, having owned the Strad for close to 30 years, this is the last intervention, so to speak, that I was going to authorize. The last time I would try to see if there's more potential power, especially in the instrument. It has a very beautiful voice, in my opinion, when it's in good voice, because instruments are very changeable. My Zygmuntowicz is more powerful, and Sam Zygmuntowicz is a prolific and wonderful violin maker who lives in Brooklyn. All the other members of my quartet have instruments by Sam Zygmuntowicz. The one that I have have is not the first Zygmuntowicz instrument that I've owned. The previous one, which may be the reason that you know something about my having two instruments, it was the subject of a book called The Violin Maker, in which the narrative thread that the writer chose to pursue was the making of this particular instrument for me and my relationship with the instrument once it was made. But the book is primarily about Sam Zygmuntowicz, and to a certain extent it's about the writer himself too. So it's like a voyage of discovery for the writer who didn't really know a lot about the world of string instruments before. So it's a very good book. A number of people in the course of my travels have asked me, oh, are you using the Zygmuntowicz? And what I need to add is that even though I got that instrument in 2002, that and I made a few of our recordings using that violin and use it for a number of our performances, probably at least 25% of our concerts over the next few years, still Sam felt that it wasn't a perfect match, and he persuaded me to exchange it for another instrument that he had made. Very often, contemporary makers will model their instruments after one or another great instrument maker from the past. So the one that I had commissioned was based on Guarneri del Gesù, who made extremely robust, powerful, dark-sounding instruments, but not quite as refined and ethereal-sounding as the instruments by Antonio Stradivari. Now, this is a big generalization the way I'm speaking about it, but it's just to give you a sketchy idea about it. So Sam felt that I would ultimately be happier with a Strad model than a Guarneri model, and that was the switch that we made almost 6 years ago now. And he was right. You know, this instrument suits me more. It is still very different from my Strad. My Strad is an early Strad from 1686, which was made before Stradivari had discovered some of the basic principles that guided the rest of his work, starting from around 1700, and which influenced so many subsequent violin makers. And I'm speaking of certain details of the proportions, and apparently he was influenced by the golden rule, or golden mean, I think that's what it's called, which has something to do with the Fibonacci series, and even something to do with the way the pyramids were built thousands of years ago. Certain proportions that are harmonious and have found their way into all sorts of architecture and construction, as well as works of art. Most instrument makers who imitate Stradivari models will use the later models. I didn't see the point in trying to get him to imitate the Strad that I already had. So it was just a sort of... it's always a gamble, you know, when you ask for a new instrument, and the maker himself, no matter how much control he has, and believe me, Sam has a great deal of technical control over what he's doing, nobody knows exactly how it's going to turn out. And likewise, the restorer, violin maker who's working on my Strad now, there's no way to guarantee what's going to happen. There are only probabilities, but no certainties in this. And I certainly hope that I won't lose any quality as a result of the restoration work that's being done on Strad now. But what Sam has said to me when I've come in with both my instruments, it seems to him that I'm trying to bring my two instruments a little closer together. Their basic characteristics are fairly far apart, but that somehow I've molded them through the choice of strings and the way I get them adjusted and just my style of playing to sound more similar, perhaps, to people listening on the outside than they seem to me while I'm playing them. Because whatever you hear under your ear, the source of the sound is, a couple of inches away from your ear. It can't be exactly the same thing as to somebody listening from a few feet away or hundreds of feet away in a large concert hall. Every time you play, it's a different perspective.
This has been
situation.
this has been fascinating to talk to you today. I really appreciate your time. I've enjoyed this a great deal. All good wishes for the performance on Sunday.
Thank you, and thank you for your attention and for the publicity that you're giving to this concert. We're very proud of the work that we've done with David Finkel over all these years. He's an amazing cellist, an amazing musician, and sort of musical entrepreneur as well in more recent years. And I'm sure, by the way, that he will continue to return to Vancouver because he also plays their cello and piano recitals with his wife.
Right.
And, so in a lot of the places where there's a sense of goodbye, it's not really completely final. We know that David's going to revisit those places, and we're ending this phase of our work together on very good terms, so probably he'll join us for performances of the Schubert Quintet for two cellos. And just as a coincidence, I should mention that our original cellist, whose name is also Eric Wilson, like the man who directs the series in Vancouver, that since he left in 1979, he has been on the faculty of UBC in Vancouver.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, he's a Canadian originally from Winnipeg, and was just a very close friend all those years ago when we started working together. So he also joined us for the Schubert Quintet at least twice in our visits to Vancouver, and we were very fortunate that every time we had a change of personnel, it was amicable.
Yeah. Yeah. The website's for more, emersonquartet.com, and friendsofchambermusic.ca. That you can get tickets there. The Emerson String Quartet performs this Sunday, the 3rd of February, 2013. That's at 3 p.m. at the Vancouver Playhouse. Founding member and violinist Eugene Drucker on the line from New York City in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.